Lodge and Pocono Gardens. Do all the things you wanted to do all summer, all day, all night. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 1-800-441-4410 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Hello and welcome to FW Presents, the anthology show for the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this is another installment of Mountain Comics, the show where I look back at the comic books I bought while on vacation in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania in the 1970s and 1980s. And joining me in the cabin this week is our pal, Mike Gillis. Hi, Mike.
Hey, good to be here.
It's been really long since you and I have podcasted together, and I'm very excited to talk about this comic, which is Conan the Barbarian, number 164. And of course, anyone who listens to Mike's shows, and you all should be doing that, Mike doesn't necessarily have a connection to Conan the comic book, but of course he has a very strong connection to the actor that played him in two, well, maybe I was about to not say two sensational movies, one sensational movie and one kind of movie.
Well, the other one, it has its moments.
It does have its moments. I'll split your head. But we can get to all that in a moment.
Sure.
But Mike, I want to ask you about, since this is your first time on the show, like, did you go on vacation to regular spots when you were a kid? Did you buy comic books on any sort of special trips or anything like that?
Not really. I was always more of a staycation latchkey kid during the summers. I had the rotating, vacations at my grandma's house that happened every so often. And that was really, most of what I bought there was like Legos, but there was a convenience store within walking distance of where I lived when I was a kid. And I picked up comics there. I think that was kind of in the era where comics as a medium were pretty new to me, and you tend to pick up a lot of random stuff before you kind of solidified the books that you really liked. So
right.
You'd pick up a random Avengers, a random Batman comic, and you kind of calibrating your tastes. So when I think of like vacation comics, I kind of think of the spinner rack and just grabbing things based on whatever whim catches me that day.
Well, that's funny you use the word random, because in a lot of ways, Conan the Barbarian is, for me, the ultimate mountain comic, because I didn't buy it regularly. It was a book that, I liked it just fine when I read it, but it just didn't have that, despite the legend, I was not a Richie Rich, and so I had a limited amount of money to spend. And so Conan was a book that I got if I had some extra money, and it looked really interesting. But when I go back and I track the issues of Conan I had as a kid, they are almost always the ones I bought when I was on vacation.
Yeah.
Because that's when I had more money to spend and I was buying more comics. I had nothing else to do but read and listen to the radio. So I don't want to say I was less choosy, but I kind of was less choosy.
Yeah.
I was buying everything I could get my hands on. And I was like, oh, Conan, I like Conan. I'll pick up Conan. And then I kind of wouldn't read it again for 10 more months until I went back to the Poconos a year later.
It's probably a good thing that Conan tends to be done in ones. So it's not like you were
exactly
locked. Yeah, you could dive into it in and out pretty easily. Most of the Conan comics, actually what I kind of find fascinating about the character is that even the original short stories that were put out by Robert E. Howard, there isn't like this strict this leads to this leads to this kind of continuity to it. It jumps around Conan's life, so he's kind of the perfect comic character to jump around on, because it's not like you're going to miss something. You get the story of old Conan as a king, young Conan wandering as a thief. There's like, it jumps around, so you probably, he's kind of the best character to read casually that way.
Right, it was perfect. I would get a complete story every time I read a Conan comic, because it was right. I mean, there wasn't like, oh, I had to read 6 months of previous Conans to get to. It was like, no. This is going to be a single adventure. And this particular story that we're going to talk about is a singular adventure. And it was Conan. I've mentioned this, I think, on the Power Records episode that I did on the Conan record, the Conan Power Record. But like, Conan is, and I have not found a great way to say this without sounding like I'm insulting it, and I'm not insulting it. But what I mean is, like, Conan is to me the greatest example of giving the audience exactly what it wants,
mm-hmm.
and it's all about how good the style is. You know, it's like in any given Conan, you know he's going to meet somebody who he probably can't trust.
Yeah.
He's going to meet a wizard. There's going to be a couple of monsters. There's going to be some very scantily clad women. And he's going to go on a journey, and he's probably going to – obviously, he's going to come out the other side of it. But, I mean, that – and you kind of know that's what you're going to get with every single issue of Conan. And each individual writer and artist serves that it is kind of like going to a fast food place.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of fast food in any country is that you know if you're in – some far-off land and you see a McDonald's, you know what you're going to get. You're going to get the hamburger that tastes like the hamburger you got in your hometown. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what Conan is. And I always feel like that sounds like I'm insulting Conan. But it's not. It's just Conan has a very definite style. And it's like, if you like this, this is what you're going to get and you're going to love it. If you don't like it, you're just not going to read the comic. But – and this issue in particular has all of the elements I just mentioned.
It's
literally this, and this. Here we go. By Crom, we're going to do it. And that's what I like about it. It's mm-hmm. very reassuring in a lot of ways.
Yeah, Conan – I get the fast food analogy. I think that Conan is a fast food restaurant that has better food than you expect it to have.
Right, yeah.
It's not right. Like McDonald's where, you know, you have this hamburger that's really one solid piece. If you drop it, it won't fall apart. This is a decent hamburger for still having a menu that's on the wall. You do kind of know what you're getting into with these covers because they tend to be very, very stylized. They want to sort of grab that look of a paperback with the sort of yellow pages where this painted half-naked guy is battling an ape that usually is wearing kind of a tattered cloak to rescue a naked woman while this, like, gaunt wizard guy is standing with his finger out in the background going, get him! I mean, and sometimes they're really great. I mean, these covers, because Conan tells you right off the bat if this is the sort of thing that you're going to be into. And you're like, okay, I'm not going to be shocked by what's in here, because this is exactly what it is. But even when you try it, it's better than you sort of expect it to be. You sort of expect that solid single-piece McDonald's hamburger, and you kind of get more of a Carl's Jr. with Conan most of the time.
Yeah, there's never going to be a deconstruction of Conan the Barbarian by Alan Moore. You know, there's not going to be Conan Barbarian the anatomy lesson where we learn that Conan is this actual, you know, spirit from another world. No, they're not going to do any of that. This is going to be what it is. And it's sort of funny you mentioned about the wizard with his finger out. I know you've mentioned on either Raider versus the Martians or on podcast La Vista Baby, maybe both. But your favorite thing in a movie is like a bad guy telling an army of people to go after the good guy with, like, you know, guards, seize him! And it's like a phalanx of people running. I know you love that in movies.
It doesn't get old. I mean, it's used over and over again, but it works all the time. So right. I'm not going to – there are certain tropes and cliches that never bother me. And that's like near the top of the list. It's like that and a hero getting stuck in a pit with closing spiked walls. I'm never going to complain about that.
Good to know. All right. Does the Death Star trench, and not the trench, but the garbage compactor, does that count?
Because there's
no spikes there, but it's closing walls. Or...
No spikes. I mean, spikes are kind of like a garnish, especially if there's like a skeleton on the spikes.
Right. Sure.
You go full on Indiana Jones with it. But yeah, I do like it. I mean, I get happy with that. It's the same thing, you know, two characters tied back to back over a pit with like crocodiles or piranhas in it. Stuff, it just doesn't get old. I mean, I want to see characters do this. It doesn't matter how many times Batman gets tied up over a pit with piranhas in it. I don't care. It's not going to get old. You can do it every issue.
All right. Yeah. Well, they said that. And that's one of the great things about Conan. And that's great about this particular issue, which, again, I said is 164. It was on sale August 7th, 1984. It features a really nice cover by Armando Gill. And we all know that there was the Savage Sword of Conan magazine, which was not. It wasn't an adult magazine. It didn't feature rampant violence and nudity the way the Warrens did, but it was aimed a little bit older audiences. The covers were a tad more salacious. I remember when I would buy it again on vacation, I had to hide it under my other comics, lest my mom see it and be like, what the hell is this thing? But this cover is maybe a little saucier than your typical Conan cover, because there's this woman and she's in the foreground and she's coming out of this melted ice thing, and she is in a incredibly tiny little bikini where she got her hands up with a sword, and Conan is approaching her with a giant broadsword kind of thing and a torch. And it's – I mean, look, there's lots of Conan covers featuring girls in frilly outfits, but this one is – I'd say probably – this probably could have worked as a Savage Sword cover as mm-hmm. well.
Yeah, the Conan books, clothing is not a thing that they're in abundance of. That's how you usually know who the wizard is, because he's the one wearing full clothing.
Right, he's got a cloak and a necklace or whatever, right?
Yeah, he has 90% of the clothes on the cover, and usually you get like sort of a loincloth or... I actually have a question for you about Conan's general outfit. He kind of has a standard house-style comic book Marvel outfit that he wears, which is sort of that big leather championship belt and maybe like a bracer or two, and then he's got his boots, but he has this, I don't know, and this is the question I want to ask, is it trunks or is it like a bearskin kilt?
Because I don't know. I've never considered this. I always took it as it's trunks because it doesn't, we've never seen it flap up on him, so I have to assume that it is trunks that he has made. Like maybe, yes, I think it's trunks.
Okay, yeah, I kind of lean that way too. I think the comics code is the deciding vote on this, but
yes,
yeah, I've always found that kind of fascinating because he's a character that does change his clothes. He doesn't wear the typical outfit in this issue. He wears actually a shirt, which is kind of neat, but. Yeah, I've always found that fascinating. And the other bit I really love on this cover that I want to talk about are the Marvel corner boxes with the John Buscema Conan drawing on it. I just want to say I absolutely love that. There's a certain kind of trade dress that I just love to death, and I wish they would still find an excuse to use it. You know, the corner box with Marvel, you know, the checkerboard for DC. You know, that banner that says Marvel Comics Group. Some of that stuff, I would bring it back permanently if I could.
Oh, when I was a kid, I used to really kind of obsess over the cover corner boxes. And when they would change it, I was like, oh, they've changed it. It's a different – I mean, I think this Conan one by Buscema, it was the only one they ever had for 90% of the book's run because it's such an iconic shot of him standing. I mean, again, who's better, the drawing Conan the Barbarian than John Buscema? But it's him standing there when he's holding a giant axe, and it was really like the classic Conan shot. But I mean, they used to change the Spider-Man and the Hulk, and I loved all that. I really do miss that. I mean, obviously, it was built for a time when newsstand distribution was still the main way of getting comics, and you had to stack your books so the full cover couldn't be shown, so you had to have these cover corner symbols so a kid could easily just kind of scan it and go, oh, Hulk, and pull it out of the pile. We don't have that anymore thanks to comic book stores. Mm-hmm. But I do miss them. They are really quite beautiful.
Yeah, and I don't know if anyone talks about it enough, but the Conan logo, I really like. It's so different from any superhero logo that you're going to see out there. It has this really rough look to it, like it was carved out of stone really roughly. It wasn't smoothed. It's definitely something that I can imagine that if I'm in 1984 and I just see that top newsstand bit with the corner box and that logo, the contrast between that and like Spider-Man and the Fantastic Four and Batman would probably really stick out and make me a lot more likely to at least be curious about what is that?
Yeah. Yeah, in this case, it's blood red. The letters are blood red, and he's got the sword on. Yeah, it's again, it's another kind of lost. As I mean, look, I'm a graphic designer, and I certainly appreciate having the access to limitless fonts and whatever you can do. But I do think that in the age where this stuff had to be done by hand, we maybe lost a little bit of creativity with this kind of stuff because it's you had to create this stuff sort of as a piece of artwork as opposed to just sort of a font that you could then manipulate. But yeah, this is one of the great Conan logos. And again, I think this was another logo that lasted a really long time.
Yeah.
I think there was a solid kind of blocky logo in the early days, and then they switched over to this, and I think this was the logo and for, again, probably 80-90% of the book's run. So they saw no need to change it because it looked – and I remembered reading that for many years, Conan was one of Marvel's consistently best-selling books. It just every month it just kept selling, you know? I mean, obviously because it probably appealed to a slightly different audience. But it was sort of funny that a book that was so distinctly cut off from the Marvel Universe, as What If comics aside, this was just, you know, a little bit of a moneymaker for Marvel Comics month in, month out.
It's weird because I think it might be the most successful licensed book that has ever been published by Marvel or DC. I think, you know, number two is obviously Star Wars, but even Star Wars didn't last as long as Conan.
No, no.
That you know, there was a wave of Star Wars popularity, and after the movie stopped coming out, it kind of ebbed a bit and kind of limped along for a few years. But Conan, they had the license from 1970 until like 1995, I think.
Something like that. It ran like 250 issues. I mean, that's quite a long run.
Incredible run that it definitely outlasted the paperback craze that kind of created the Conan popularity that led to them wanting to get this license in the first place. So it's remarkably successful. And then you consider that after, Marvel was done with it. It went to Dark Horse for like 15 years. Mm-hmm. And it's been continually going since 1970 from one company or another. I mean, I can't think of very many licensed comics that don't at least have a 2 or 3 year break in them.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, he's consistently, I mean, outside of the one movie with Jason Momoa, which really didn't do any business.
No.
And then wasn't there a TV series too? Like yeah. A syndicated TV series? There hasn't been a lot of multimedia support for Conan, and yet as a comic book, it's continually popular.
Yeah, Rolf Muller was, I think, the name of the guy who played Conan on the TV show. Our friend Greg Hatcher had described Rolf as saying that it was like if an Easter Island statue had a body underneath it, that was basically both Rolf and his performance. Weirdly enough, that guy played in Batman and Robin, the second Arkham Asylum guard next to Jesse Ventura.
Okay, wow,
so
that's
are,
a random point.
There are two Conans
in
that scene.
That's, yeah, oh man. That is, wow, okay, that is very strange. And there was, there was the Conan line of toys, mm-hmm. briefly. There was the action figures. But yeah, I mean, he's kind of really just been a continually popular comic book character. And this is one of my favorite issues of the Mount Comics because it is so much fun. So in this issue, the story is called The Jeweled Sword of Tem by Larry Okada, Gary Quaspiz, I think that's how you say it. Janice Chiang, George Russos, Larry Hom is the editor, and Jim Shooter is editor-in-chief. Conan has been followed by some days by Vedin Kamal, a young man who wants revenge on Conan for killing his brothers. His inept stalking ends when he finally makes a move on the barbarian, who lays him out with one blow. Conan dismisses him, telling him to come back when he's a warrior, but the boy asks to be Conan's apprentice. Conan declines until Vedin reveals he can help Conan find the Jeweled Sword of Tem. Vedim leads Conan to the imprisoned wizard Madhiva, see there's a wizard, who directs the two to a mountain pass and cavern. After several days' journey and encountering a savage monkey man in the snowy hills, the two find the cavern and inside a river flowing in the icy mountains. They find a canoe and follow the foul-smelling river past dinosaurs frozen in ice until they reach the ancient temple of the Dark Angels. Conan breaks the door down and sees two women frozen in the ice along with a sword. He chips away at the ice and Vedin takes the sword, suddenly turning on Conan in order to get his revenge. The power of the sword begins to wear Conan down, but an explosion occurs as the Dark Angels awaken. The two evil women attempt to destroy the sword and the two men, blasting Vedin into charred flesh, and Conan grabs the sword and slits the throat of one of the women. The other blasts Conan into the river, but he emerges and plunges the sword into her. The two immortal women crawl back into their tomb to be refrozen, saying they will return when another comes to claim the sword, but Conan throws it into the river. He leaves behind a crippled and nearly dead Vedin. He begs Conan to kill him, but Conan ignores his pleas and floats away. So, I mean, like I mentioned at the top of the show, this has every element you want out of a Conan comic book.
Yeah.
So what did you think of this story?
Oh, it has a couple things that I really like with Conan, which is that the stakes of Conan's stories aren't like The Lord of the Rings, which is the other big fantasy franchise. They're not world-shaking. You're not fighting for the freedom of all people in Middle-earth. You're not trying to stop the wizard from destroying everyone with the blue beam in the sky. Conan is kind of here on personal stakes. There are elements that could be world-shaking, but Conan is straight up not interested in them. He really doesn't care. He's somebody who's remarkably practical because he is always doing a math equation in his head of, is this worth my time? Is this worth the trouble? And when that number goes to, no, this is not worth my time. This is more trouble than it's worth. He's willing to set the whole thing on fire and walk away. That a lot of other comic characters, like, you know, with Spider-Man or Batman, are always kind of in that mode of, I have an ideological need to protect innocent people, and this is my job. Conan is kind of in it for himself, and that's the sort of amoral aspect of the character that sets him apart. He wants to make a few bucks, he likes getting in fights, and he sort of has this desire to become a king someday. And if something isn't helping him get there, or if it looks like, you know, because this is not his first rodeo, he's been scammed a bunch of times by someone saying, hey, I know where there's magical treasure.
Right.
So
right.
He goes right into the Socratic method and is just like, okay, why should I believe you? You just tried to stab me. Who is this friend and why doesn't he get the sword himself if it's so great? If it's so easy, why isn't this solved itself? Because I kind of love the idea that Conan kind of goes into this thinking it might be a scam, but he still thinks he might profit from it, so he's going to go along with it for now. And that's the part of the story that I love the most, that there are these potentially old, ancient, mysterious elements that Conan really only cares about the top layer of. And when those things become something that is just like, okay, too much, you know, you went over 21, bust, I'm done. He'll set it on fire and walk. I mean, at that point in which he said at the end decides, okay, that wizard who needs this sword to get escape, you know, from his tower, he's probably in there for a reason. I don't care what that reason is, I'm leaving. I'm not even going to go back to him. Just let him be trapped there. And set the cave on fire, walk away. And I kind of love that. Even destroys a sword, the sword isn't worth the trouble.
Right.
And it's not the beginning of a 6-part story where Conan wants to learn the secret history of this sword or who these mysterious demigod women are. He doesn't care about who the wizard was. He's just like, okay, yeah, too much. Bye. Done, guys. And I love that about his character. There's just something utterly practical and blunt. And he's just really not interested or easily impressed.
Right. I love the opening bit where the guy, the kid is sneaking up on him and Conan is busy eating a big hunk of chicken or whatever the hell meat he's eating. And it's a very Batman moment where the kid thinks he's got the drop on Conan. And then, of course, Conan turns right around and smacks him, never revealing that he knows he's there the whole time, which, again, is a very kind of Batman thing that he's – I mean, Conan is – not supposedly a very smart guy. He's a, you know, he's a barbarian, but nevertheless, anyone who has lived to this age in this lived to be as long as Conan has been around in the Hyborian age has obviously got to be pretty smart because, you know, death awaits you at every turn in this place. So I like that whole angle. It's sort of funny. The outfit that the kid is wearing, he's got this red vest and a yellow shirt and it almost looks like blue jeans. I mean, they're obviously not, but they sort of, he looks kind of like a little more like contemporary character. You're right. I mean, Conan, he's been made this offer a million times before, and he doesn't trust anybody, but he goes along with it, and he figures he's got his wits about him that in case the minute it looks bad, he's gonna bail with this stuff, and so why not give it a try? But he said this has has the protagonist who maybe can't be trusted. It's got the wizard who looks like a classic wizard, as you say. He's even got pointed shoes.
Yeah,
this wizard. I mean, he is right out of central casting. And then they go on the horses. They get attacked by the wolves, and Conan beats up one of the wolves. They have the classic nighttime thing where I like the bit where the kid's asking him. He says, "Do you hate him? Do you feel bad afterwards?" And Conan's like, about killing somebody. He says, "Just another chore. Are you frightened? Does it make you feel good or bad?" And he says, if you enjoy killing, the world will despise you. If you hate killing, you will despise yourself. Mm. Which is about as much introspection as we're going to get out of Conan the Barbarian, I would say.
Yeah, Conan is not especially deep guy. I think he's intelligent as a character, but he isn't really interested in philosophizing. That everything has a use or a purpose. And the people that he tends to really respect are people that don't put up with him or put up with danger, who don't whine, and people that, even if they're not very powerful, who still fight as hard as they can. That's the sort of stuff that Conan likes. Conan tends to roll his eyes at people that go all damsel-y on him.
Right, yeah.
And I think he kind of is sort of looking at this kid trying to figure out, which one are you? Are you going to be somebody that I'm going to regret bringing along?
Right, right. I love when they get out to the mountain pass and they run into like these Sasquatch type guys. And I love the first shot of them is they're cooking a guy. There's a guy in the flames and his arm is outstretched, which suggests to me that he's not totally dead maybe at this point. And that's one of the great things about the world of Conan is that these creatures exist literally around every turn. I mean, there's just constant death awaits you no matter what. And, of course, I mean, 164 issues in and plus however many issues of Savage Sword, Conan isn't terribly scared by any of these guys. He just knows he's got to handle them right. He uses the kid as bait. And then when the snow beasts turn around, then he jumps on – he says, "I guide my own steel," and he stabs them in the chest. And he's standing over them, even though these snow beasts are like a good 12 feet tall. But, again, it's just sort of another day at the office for Conan the Barbarian.
Yeah, it's – again, this is not his first rodeo. He's probably killed a dozen of these things that he knows walking through the mountain pass means there's a good odds of him running into this stuff. He – It's the same thing with the kid. The kid has trailed him for 3 days, which means he's gone to sleep in front of this kid. That's how non-threatened and how lightly Conan sleeps, that he's willing to just... He's curious because he wants to know when this kid's going to make his move, because he doesn't feel like... But he could just kill the kid, but he wants to know where it's going. There's a certain curiosity that drives Conan. But yeah, that curiosity is tempered with this cynicism that he's done this 1,000 times. There's 1,000 people. Oh my God, you have to help my brother. Or you killed my dad. Or, you know, Conan's like, okay, you'll have to be more specific. It's, you know, this, he's done this so many times. And I kind of love the fact that every one of his questions are designed to decide if this is another scam, because he's been there. There's been another wizard who wants him to get a thing. There's been another kid who wants him to be his mentor. There's another, you know, ice ape, you know, it's just, so it's, I like that aspect, that sort of jaded shell on Conan that kind of has kept him alive where a lot of these side characters die.
Right. Right. Yeah. They make it to the temple, and the temple looks again like something right out of Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Tomb of the Dark Angels, which I mentioned. It's got this these two statues that are looming over the door that are a good 30, 40 feet high. Again, it would be something that probably Indiana Jones would discover many years later. We see the two girls in the ice, and then the kid gets the sword, and it possesses him, and he thinks he can take Conan out, which, of course, he's going to be wrong. Now, I don't want to like over-discuss this for many reasons, but am I crazy? But the two women that come out, the two wizard girls that come out of the ice, are they a little more scantily clad than you would have expected in a code approved comic in 1984? They seem just a little more revealing than I would have expected for a made newsstand comic.
I think that's kind of how Conan rolls as a comic. Conan the Barbarian is all about kind of skirting that line. That, you know, they kind of know that Conan as a property is a bit more salacious than you know, your average issue of The Amazing Spider-Man, that this is not a guy who ties up the bad guys and leaves them for the police. This is a guy who later in the fight with these women straight up slits that woman's throat with the sword.
Yep. Yep.
And it's actually remarkably violent for a code-approved book. I mean, obviously they can't have this arterial spray go everywhere, but if you notice, there's sort of an arc of a motion line when he slashes her, and there's a kind of a muddy black inkness to that motion line that implies blood.
Yep.
That, along with the scantily cladness, is just that sort of a sense that you're kind of, when you're a young kid reading this, you kind of feel like you're getting away with something reading Conan the Barbarian.
Yes, yes.
And it makes it kind of exciting. You're like, wow, Batman doesn't do that to a bad guy. I mean, Conan does just not mess around. And this is still Conan with the safety on. You got a lot more Conan, you know, with guns free on Savage Sword. But there was always this element of Conan the Barbarian that felt like it was pushing the boundaries a little harder than your average Marvel comic.
I guess you have to figure that the Comics Code Authority, by this point, by Conan the Barbarian having been published every month for 14 years, you know, the world didn't end.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, nobody stormed the front doors of the Comics Code Authority because they passed something in a Conan comic that shouldn't have been passed. So you got to figure by this point, they were just sort of going over the pages with kind of like probably one eye towards lunch and one eye towards doing their actual job, because it's like, you know what? People know what they're getting when they buy a Conan comic at this point. So, yeah, these girls have bikini bottoms on that are basically just covering what, you know, pubic hair might be there, but that's it.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a scantily clad you can get away with, but I have to wonder, the CCA is probably just, this is fine. It's all right. It's Conan. We all know what's going on. And then, of course, the sort of a kicker to this story is after they get frozen back in the ice, which I like. I like that they go back in the ice.
Yeah.
And they're kind of like, we'll come out another day when somebody goes after the sword. I think that's – now, of course, we know that Conan's going to chuck the sword into the water, so they're going to be frozen forever. But I like that he doesn't – they don't just die. They actually crawl back into their sort of tomb. And then this kid begs for life. He's laying there, and we see him, and we can tell that he is partly immolated. On the final page, he's reaching towards Conan, and his arm is bent in a way that an arm shouldn't bend. And we see that one part of his leg is charred, and one of his arms is charred. So he's been kind of – Darth Vader'd, you know, on the lava planet.
Uncle Owen there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, he's really, and he's begging for Conan to end his life, and Conan is like, you do your own chores. And he gets on the little boat and takes off, and that's the end of the story. And you're just, Conan's like, wah, wah. Conan's just like, forget it. I'm not bothering. I don't kill if I don't absolutely have to, and I don't have to kill you. You got yourself into this, Junior. You get yourself out. And that's the end of the story. It's,
yeah.
You betcha.
Yeah, it's just, that's where these skeletons and these things come from. I kind of love Conan. He doesn't take the first murder attempt personally, because I think Conan kind of has that aspect of, okay, I killed your three older brothers. It's only fair. But the second time, you had your chance. You failed.
Right.
You know, you don't get to do this twice to me. And now you live with the consequences of your actions, and goodbye. He's that's what I love. There's just something, again, Conan does not mess around. And it's just something that, you know, I mean, yeah, maybe Golden Age Batman did stuff like this with a fitting end for their kind, but
right.
It's not something a lot of post-code superheroes ever did. They weren't that callous to something like this. They all had that moment where it's just like, the bad guy's gonna is falling off the cliff. I'm gonna try to rescue the bad guy. Conan's like, nope, let him die.
Yeah.
And there was, again, it adds to that element where you kind of feel like, wow, am I allowed to read this when you're 10 years old? And that's what I kind of like about it, is there's something weirdly transgressive about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, what do you think of this the writer, Larry Yakata? I am completely unfamiliar with him, other than I looked him up on Mike's Amazing World, and he has a bunch of Conan credits, mm-hmm. and that's it. He literally wrote no other comic book other than a Conan story, whether either for this book or for Savage Sword, and then he has no other credits past basically the 80s. What do you think of it as a story? I mean, again, this really is what we talked about. It is the hamburger. It is just what you want out of a Conan story. I mean, do you think this guy... I don't know. Just overall, what did you think of Larry Yakata's script?
I think he got the character really well of Conan. I think that he got what the tenor and tone of a Conan story is. That, you know, this is a guy who kind of wanders into other people's stories and wanders out when they become too much for him. The practicality of Conan, the fact that Conan isn't just a dumb brute, that there's a cunning there, that there's somebody who's constantly thinking and trying to figure out when he wants to leave the story. That's always been Conan. And I think he nails that down really well.
Yeah. I'm always kind of fascinated how you can, you know, what happens to guys like this who write couple, you know, was obviously employable for a very brief time and then just not again. I wonder what happened to him. And then the art by Gary Quaspis, he had a much longer career at Marvel. In fact, his credits, he had a credit from just a couple of years ago. It's sort of funny when I look at what Marvel gave him to do. He for DC, he did Hawkman, but when he was at Marvel, most of his credits are Conan, Wolverine, or The Punisher.
Yeah.
So clearly, he was kind of a man's man when it terms of the you know, the stories they gave him. They really figured he was good at tough guys, and he was. I actually think the art is really, really solid in this comic.
I do, too. There's a couple bits that I really like. I love the focus on backgrounds. I know that there's a lot of artists who are really interested in drawing figures and letting the backgrounds kind of fall away. But I think with fantasy, the backgrounds are really important because it sort of sets the world as a character.
Right.
And the wildness and scariness of that world, like when they're at the campfire at the beginning, there's sort of this oppressive darkness. They really feel like they're in a cave of a clearing. It really feels – and the same thing too when they're on the mountain pass. It really sells how high up they are and how dangerous even the terrain is, that it's probably not safe to fight these giant ape guys anywhere, but it's really dangerous to fight them here. And even that bit where he finds out later that the kid cut his rope to try to kill Conan while they're climbing the mountain, there's this bit where Conan falls. And you see how Conan's hair comes up. It's sort of a controlled fall. Like, Conan's not afraid by his posture.
Right.
But he can't control his movement. And the way his hair moves, and even later when they're looking down on the valley of eternal darkness, you see the wind blow in Conan's hair. And I think Conan's hair is kind of a secret weapon to good artists, that it's easy to just have it lay flat all of the time. But it works to sort of emphasize motion lines. It's a way to show how Conan is moving, what the wind is doing. Remembering to put that stuff in there reminds you that he's in a wild location.
Oh, absolutely. A lot of artists did that for Aquaman when he was underwater. His hair sometimes was stiff, and other times it was blowing in a direction. Because, like, well, yeah, because he's got the water is moving in a direction, and it's moving it.
Exactly, and I think Aquaman's a great example because when he's underwater, the really great artists of Aquaman remember that the bubbles around him can work as motion lines. That this character isn't sort of in a void, that these characters are in a location and you make that location part of their action, whether it's wind or it's the water currents around them. It's something that reminds you that they're in a place and that they're experiencing a thing, that they're not just on a stage with a bunch of flat, you know, sort of cardboard sets. And the things like that, especially with fantasy, is just setting that wild, dangerous location of, if you weren't somebody like Conan, you're going to die out here. And if you can sell that, you really sell the comic.
Yeah, I agree. I said, and I think Gary did a nice job. I agree with you about the backgrounds. It's got, I mean, for a 22-page story, it has a whole bunch of interesting settings. You've got the mountain pass, you've got the forest, you've got the snow thing. I love on page, I think it's 4, when they go to the Wizard Castle. And it's this big castle built precariously on the top of this, you know, rock pillar. And the only way you can get to it is this rope bridge. And you're like, how the hell did that even get built?
Yeah.
Like, how did anybody in an age before, I guess slaves, I guess that's the answer to everything. They just made slaves do it. But, I mean, it's quite a nice place this wizard has. And then we briefly see the inside of it, and we see he's got a library and a map. Like, he's got like, a really nice place. He's, like, the 1%
yeah.
of the Hyborian age. He's practically got electricity in this place. It's so nice.
It's kind of funny that you mentioned that, the 1%, because there is always kind of a class analysis that's always going on in Conan books, that Conan is this guy who is self-made, and he's frequently getting caught up in the stories of really rich, wealthy, soft people who live in really nice houses who think that he's stupid.
Right, right.
And it's usually him turning the tables on these people who are just like, oh, this dumb barbarian, I can manipulate him into forwarding my plans. And then that's the guy who, like, 20 pages later, you know, Conan is hucking this guy off a cliff.
Right. Right. Yeah,
exactly. That they don't expect him to be smart. They don't expect him to expect them to be devious. They expect him to be, you know, they kind of like that. He goes into a lot of nice houses. In fact, one of my favorite Conan character moments is in the Conan newspaper strip back in the early 80s. And there's a bit where Conan rescues this prince from a dungeon and is taking the prince back to the borders of his homeland. And all the way the prince is promising him all these things. Oh, my God, you're going to be the captain of my guard. You're going to be showered in women and gold and gems. And Conan's just kind of riding along silently. And eventually they get to the borders of the kingdom. And Conan goes, okay, this is about far enough. You're not the first prince I've rescued who's promised me everything, only to kick me away like a dog when we get to your castle. I'm just going to take what money you have on you right now, and we'll call it even. And he robs the guy and leaves. And I love that. You know, a lot of these, there's a lot of real fancy people that thinks that they're so smart and Conan is so dumb. And it kind of plays into Robert E. Howard as a person, is that he was a guy who grew up in these oil boom towns. I mean, he grew up where rich guys would show up saying, oh, we're going to find oil and everyone in town is going to be rich and everything's going to be great. And of course, the rich guys get all the oil, leave a bunch of empty holes, and leave you with the poverty. And Conan was kind of his response to that in a lot of ways, which is, no, I may not have gone to your fancy college, but I'm self-taught by going to the library. I'm smarter than you, and I'm going to throw you off a cliff now.
Wow. And I didn't know any of that about Robert E. Howard. That's amazing.
Yeah, he was definitely a self-taught guy who was really sick of fancy people thinking he was stupid. And Conan really is the personification of that feeling of a guy who rises in the world because of his own skill and his own brains and his own cunning, rather than these foils that he runs up against, usually wizards, who live right, in fancy yeah. houses and sit on cushions and think he's stupid. And it's kind of fun for that. It's the idea of a meritocracy as a brutish fantasy world.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. I didn't know any of that. That's really cool. That's a fascinating backstory to that he would that's how, you know, how it kind of like manifested itself in Robert E. Howard's life. That's really cool. I like that. And you know, speaking of kind of like a smart move or kind of a canny move, I like at the very end where Conan pitches the sword into the flames and destroys it.
Yeah.
I like that. He's sort of like, this is just going to cause more trouble. He talks about the wizard girls, and he's like, someone locked Mihira up here for good reason, and the ancients went to a lot of trouble to secrete this sword, and agree with a lot of them. Neither should see the light of day. And it's a great shot of the two girls as they're reduced to just skeletons, and the flame just burns the sword, and it's very much like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, where you almost see kind of like ghostly faces in the smoldering ruins. But I love that. I like that Conan's like, this thing's more trouble than it's worth for somebody else, so to hell with it, and we're just going to end it all right here. I think that's great.
I do. It's Conan refusing to be part of a 6-part story. Right. And going, I don't want your crossover. I'm done. And it's a practicality that a lot of other heroic characters just don't have, because they get curious about the mythology behind the mythology. And he's like, I don't care. I don't want this.
Yeah, I like it. I like it a lot. And I said, that's what made it such a good Mountain comic, is that it was like, I need something to entertain myself for the length of how long it's going to take me to read this. And while I appreciate longer form stories, I would buy, you know, JLA in the middle of a 5-part crossover. I also enjoyed these too. And it was Conan was just that perfect book. And so I would buy basically 2, maybe 3 Conans a year, but they were always around August, whatever ones I could get my hands on, because it was like, hey, this is not something I generally have money to spend on in my normal life, but here I do. And this is going to really entertain me. And I know what I'm going to get. And I like what I'm going to get. And that's, this comic really delivers that. It's really, in a lot of ways, like an iconic Conan book. It just has all the elements in it with a little bit of an extra touch. So well done, Larry Yacata and Gary Quaspis.
Absolutely.
All right. So, well, that's going to do it for this issue of Conan the Barbarian. Mike, this was super fun. I always enjoy talking to you. I'm a huge fan of your shows, obviously.
Oh, thank you.
And I love podcast La Vista Baby. And, of course, we all know that Arnold Schwarzenegger played Conan in 2 movies. This is a little off topic, but I do want to ask you while I've got you here. Do you really want to see Conan, King Conan, as played by Arnold? Or do you think that moment has passed?
I'm kind of curious because I think that the Conan movies had originally been intended to be a trilogy, the third one with him becoming king. I think the fact that Arnold himself is actually much older now might save that movie because it forces it to be something different. I'm just going to say it's the same kind of cautious optimisms. I'm going to approach this the way Conan approached this story. There might be something into it, there might be something here, and it might work out for me, but I'm going to be cautious, I'm going to ask a lot of questions, and I'm going to be prepared to walk away.
I think that's probably smart, because as you'll hear, you know, if they actually do make the movie, and we'll hear about the development of it, and it all will depend on who the screenwriter is, who the director is. If we hear it's somebody terrible, we'll go, oh boy, what's that movie, what was that Arnold movie you guys hated, the more recent one?
Oh, Sabotage.
Sabotage?
I don't have to ask anymore what the worst Arnold movie we're going to watch
right,
is.
Right, right. So it's like if we hear that, like, oh, they've tapped the director of Sabotage to direct the new King Conan, you're going to go, all right, I'm out. Yeah. I'm done. Oh. But if they get somebody interesting, then maybe not, you know? So it'll be interesting. Yeah. I mean, Conan the Barbarian, the movie, was one of the big moments in my childhood life. I've talked about in many other podcasts about how my dad took me and my sister to see movies. And of course, this is the 1980. It's pre-internet. The only thing you had to go by was like a newspaper ad and maybe a commercial. So my dad didn't know anything. And he took me to Conan.
Oh.
The movie's rated R. I was 9 years old.
Boy, is it ever rated R.
You know? And I mean, it's like, I remembered watching this, you know, where he's banging the girl in the hut. And I was like, wow. I was like, am I supposed to be seeing this? You know,
yeah.
I had no idea what my dad's reaction was. But that was a big movie for me because it's pretty out there for a kid to see. But, you know, it was a comic book. As far as my dad knew, it's a comic book. It's probably all right. So, you know, okay, cool. It's good stuff. So, Oh, anyway, thank you so much, Mike. I really enjoy talking to you, and we don't do it nearly enough. So when can you tell people where they can find you on the internet?
Well, my main venture is Radio Versus the Martians. We're sort of a rotating group of guests that talk pop culture topics. We just did an episode on Spider-Man. We covered the pilot episode of Columbo. We've talked about anime, manga. We've, you know, everything. We cross the board. Anything that catches our interest, and you can find that at RadioVersusTheMartians.com. And you mentioned, of course, our spinoff show, which is a look at every movie in the canon of Arnold Schwarzenegger. We're about halfway through that project, and that's at podcastalavistababy.com and, you know, iTunes, Stitcher, all the regular places.
Mike's not mentioning that Radio vs. Martians has a Patreon page. And I would recommend all of you go to – I mean, again, I'm sure anyone listening to this subscribes to Radio Versus the Martians. But if you don't, go check out those shows. They're really highly entertaining. And go to Patreon and support it. I'm becoming much more vocal about supporting podcasts because as more – I know how much work goes into them. And I sort of appreciate other people that do it. And so I contribute to various podcasts. And so if you like these shows, and I know you will, go to Patreon and throw Mike and Casey a dime here and there, or maybe a gold coin in this, if we want to keep the analogy going, so they can keep doing their shows, because it's absolutely worth the time. So thanks everybody for listening. Of course, you can find back episodes of Mountain Comics on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. This is part of the FW Presents feed. You can just type in Mountain or Mountain Comics and you'll find all the back episodes of the show. The show has its own Twitter feed over on, of course, Twitter, which is at Mountain Comics. So thanks everybody for listening. Mike and I are going to crack open a few yoo-hoos and sit out on the porch and watch the sun go down and talk about Conan some more. So thanks everybody for listening, and we will see you later. Bye.